OTB Culture Club, brought to you by Now TV. Watch whatever you're in the mood for.
All right, you're very welcome along to this week's edition of the OTB Culture Club, sponsored by Now TV. Watch whatever you're in the mood for on Now TV. And I'm delighted to say our special guest this week is Dermot Kennedy. Dermot, in some environments, you're quite famous as a singer, but actually it's as a footballer that many other people might know you from the Leinster Senior League.
Imagine.
2015, 2016, that was the heyday of your time bestriding the Leinster Senior League like a colossus.
Yeah, that was probably 2015, 2016 probably was the best time for me playing football. That was class, yeah. Like, it was just, I played for Rathcoole, which is just local for me, and it was that beautiful thing, just playing with your friends for years. Then I went to Nace, and then eventually went to Crumlin, yeah. Playing in Crumlin was the best thing, though.
Crumlin are pretty good. Like, there's a very good standard, a long tradition of, like, world-class footballers coming from Crumlin.
Yeah, it felt class, and you can just tell, I don't know, like, it can be such an intimidating thing when you're changing team, and especially they were just known as like such a strong club, but it was just a really welcoming atmosphere, and it became something that was so important to me, just as part of my life and as part of my week, and especially as music got busier and all that, it's like there's so much that you put everything into music, you constantly think about it, there's so much emotion involved, and football was just this release whenever I needed it. So it was just this lovely sort of routine, and it was very important to my life, yeah.
There's always a good story about amateur footballers changing clubs. So what was your, like, was it a big money move across town to kind of, you know, what happened?
Nah, it was grand. I wasn't sought after enough for it to be a controversial thing.
Where did he play, Dermot? What sort of footballer were you?
Played in centre midfield. I kind of always played in centre midfield. Mm. And I went playing senior when I was like 18. And I was tiny and I was real wiry. And I never got tired ever playing. But this thing was happening where I was playing against like 30-year-olds. And if it came to it physically, I just got bashed. And so I ended up like going to the gym loads and all that. And then I got bigger and lost a certain amount of pace. So I would say I gradually sort of declined, because the best thing, like, you cannot sort of, like, no matter how big and strong you get, you can't beat that feeling of just like being able to run around the pitch and outrun everybody. It's a beautiful thing.
Mm. Come here. You're obviously not playing football anymore. Or like, do you miss it?
Oh, I miss it like mad. Yeah. I think, like I was saying, it was really important to me in terms of relief. And the way people, the same way, like when you kind of are on stage doing that and you get that feeling and you just feel comfortable and sort of at peace, I think sport was that for me too. So I miss it an awful lot, yeah.
Yeah, I saw you making that point actually in the tweet with Jimmy Butler there recently, that it's interesting, the level of ambition required is very similar, the level of dedication is very similar. Is the level of adrenaline similar? I know, obviously, the music career has gone a hell of a lot better than the football career,
and yeah,
I'm sure the
yeah,
football
of course.
Career went well, but still, there is a relative sense of adrenaline you would have got off being a footballer. Are they way comparable?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I really, really, really do think so. And music's a funny one, because my vocal coach was saying this to me recently. He said the music industry is set up in such a way that you have to be really tough and ambitious and aggressive almost to get what you want. But then your character is to be super sensitive and like really gentle, and that has to live in your music. So in sport, maybe you can always kind of like say the likes of LeBron James or whoever, it can all be just aggressive and push forward and just work, whereas in music you have to like check yourself and make sure you're creatively centered and being balanced and all that. But it definitely takes a similar amount of work, I'd say. That's why like when I do run into the likes of Jimmy Butler, I don't sort of think like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Because I think it's a similar sort of journey, you know?
Mm-hmm. Come here, how are you getting the release, like obviously before this happened, that you were getting from sport now that you're not playing football and you don't have that organized outlet in your life to take you out of the constantly being consumed by being in tune with everything that you've just spoken about there?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's hard sometimes, especially when you're on tour for a couple of months and like it gets to a point on tour where you are just tired sometimes, so you don't force yourself to go running around Dallas or Albuquerque or wherever you are, and you find it. I think you kind of get, I think you do get a buildup of not even necessarily anxiety, but just you can find yourself, like, if you don't have that release over a while, it can just be a little bit stressful, I think. But that's why, like, I struggle with just going for a run. I always say that to people, because, like, nothing compares to playing a match when you're actually competing with people and there's a ball to chase and there's something on the line. I find it mad just kind of going for a run for an hour, you know?
Yeah, like, I'm not sure, did you see the Liam Gallagher documentary recently? But it's interesting when he's kind of, when there's footage of him on tour at the moment and he's got his family and he's going for his runs in the morning and he's keeping himself healthy. Complete sea change from Liam Gallagher, tour days of the 90s. On what end of the spectrum are you? Are you 90s Liam Gallagher or are you 2019 Liam Gallagher?
Nah, yeah, I would be closer to 2019. I do, I look after myself, and the schedule is so mad that I think you couldn't do it any other way. There's times when you're playing four nights in a row and you're in four different cities and there's flights in between and there's promo in between and all that. So I'm definitely on the more boring end of the scale when it comes to partying and all that. But I don't know. I think especially a big thing for me is my voice, keeping on top of that and being able to go out and do it, because I put an awful lot of strain on it. So, it is a boring sort of, it's definitely not like the partying lifestyle, but I do think you have to treat it like an athlete almost. If you want to do a good job all the time, I think you have to be quite careful. Yeah, you have to sleep and like you have to be the one that at like straight away after a gig, you're like, I'm good, like I'm going to bed. I can't go out to a bar in every city we're in, you know.
So you're late stage Roy Keane as opposed to early stage Roy Keane.
Yeah. Yeah, that was mental, wasn't it, when he started out? Just in the book and everything. It's just like, yeah, he used to basically go out for drinks and a scrap every time he felt like it, yeah.
Nights in the cells where Ferguson would arrive down and get him out and wouldn't say anything to him because, you know, he probably couldn't. If he started talking, he wouldn't have stopped. But there's all sorts of stories. There's, like, I think some of the best stories didn't even make it into Roy's book. There's other books out there that are worth digging out for that. Okay, one of the things you talked about on social media recently was about embracing the stillness. This is obviously a very unusual time for all of us. You've been playing gigs kind of most nights on Instagram and on various charities' Facebook pages just to help out. What has this whole experience been like for you?
It's been cool. I mean, I can't lie that it at the beginning, it's a strange thing to have been on tour and playing all these beautiful venues and theaters, and then you're like setting up in your living room and trying to treat that with the same amount of respect and all that. And so it can be something that I'm quite cynical about, literally until you start playing the songs, because it's just, you can instantly see that people care about it and that they've showed up and that they are there to listen. And then obviously the most important thing is that I'm doing it for charity basically every time I'm doing it. So it's just nice. And you get comments after, people saying like they kind of look forward to it because everybody's stuck at home and that could be so hard for people. So I think there's a lot of people saying they look forward to them. And it's been a nice sort of little new thing, because obviously it's a tiny corner of society, but like I think all musicians are adapting to this now and everybody's kind of scrambling to figure out how they do their jobs in this weird time. And so, but they've been enjoyable, and if I can help and make people's day slightly easier and raise a bit of money too, I think it's a good thing. Yeah,
you're of a generation where the power of the internet was something that really helped grow an audience, and it's funny because the original Napster was supposed to kill the music industry and was going to prevent new music from ever being discovered because people would actually not have the opportunity to discover it because the record companies weren't going to put millions and millions behind the marketing campaigns. Yeah. But actually what happened was there was a democratization of the pathway, so you could put a song up on YouTube and if it was good, people would watch it. Missing the connection with the audience, I guess, is something though that as somebody who does tour quite a lot, that bit isn't there, but there is the YouTube and there are the Spotify figures and there is everything else going on. So what is that like?
Oh, 100%. And if there's anywhere, obviously social media and just online presence is an important part of my career, whether I
choose to accept it or not. And if anything, when I'm busy on tour and all that, I it's the only place I kind of slow down and maybe fall down slightly, but I never care because I'm doing it in real life. I'm like, I'm not going to post all day today because I have a gig tonight. And like, that is just at the forefront of my mind. But so now, if anything, this kind of gives me a chance to be more present in that way. And yeah, like we've got songs lying around that just songs that didn't make the album. And so now this is the thing, like potentially, do we just release a bunch of extra songs? Do we do like a surprise sort of EP or something? I'm not sure, but there's loads of stuff to do. Even Hozier, when he was on the late the other night, it's like Take Me to Church was his first release, you know, like and it was, and I literally remember Michal, our drummer, showing it to me in his kitchen and just being like, oh, there's this song I heard, and that was that. I think it had a few thousand views, but it just shows you, like, you can literally have a career just based off something blown up on the internet. It's crazy.
It's interesting, actually, Jordan, you mentioned Napster there. Like, I'm not sure if either of you have read this, but I'm reading Lizzie Goodman's oral history book on New York post-2001 and the music scene there at the moment. And she touches on that point of Napster and how not only does it bring an audience closer to the artist, it also widens the audience's music tastes dramatically. It's like why you have record labels like DFA Records coming up in New York as a result of that, where they don't pick one genre. They completely spread out. And I think that's been the case in your career as well so far, Dermot. I mean, working with Mike Dean is something interesting. It's something that an artist in your position may not have done 20 years ago, maybe not even 10 years ago. Can you talk through that experience working with somebody who's known for working with Kanye and Tupac and Jay-Z?
Yeah, of course. That's really interesting that you say that. And I think that probably does go a long way towards why genres are so loose these days. And before I even mentioned Mike Dean, the person that often comes into my head is Travis Scott, because it's obviously this heavy, heavy hip hop, but it's so melodic and musical as well. And obviously Mike Dean goes a long way towards making that happen. But yeah, it's just things are kind of looser than ever. And you see like how important James Blake was in the making of Travis Scott's album. It's just everybody, just whoever's creative is invited. And if it's new and if it's fresh, then people want to do it. But working with Mike Dean was cool. Yeah, it like you never know what to expect when you're going around LA, like, and there's a new thing in your calendar and you haven't met the person before. You literally just rock up, like get an Uber to an address, you don't know where it is, and you just go in and try and do your best. And sometimes it's difficult, but sometimes it's easy. But with him it was easy. He's the nicest guy, like really is, especially considering he's achieved more than anybody, but he's still, and especially he's achieved so much, but it's still completely about the music, like 100%. I saw the maddest thing. I think it was something like something he's worked on has been released every 7 days for the last 27 years or something. How hard he works is just mental. So it was really cool. And also like, that was a year and a bit ago probably that I worked with him, and so he certainly didn't know who I was, and he treated me as if I sort of had a giant reputation, you know. He just, I think if you make music, he just cares and he wants to work with you. It's really cool.
How does something like that come about? Is that like, I guess it strikes me that you have to be willing yourself to experiment and experience new things, and that speaks to a curiosity, I would suggest, about what else is out there. But how does something like that actually come about in the first place?
In terms of how it actually happens, it's just labels getting in touch, but also in terms of me being open to it, yeah, it took me a long time to be willing to work with people. I always had this, I'm a big fan of Bon Iver and Hozier and Ben Howard and stuff, and I think those are artists who sort of keep to themselves and do everything themselves, and I always thought like that, and I always loved the idea of recording at home, and I never wanted to share anything with anybody because I was horrified by this idea of like, oh, what if they suggest a certain line of lyric and then I end up on tour for 2 years singing what they thought about. And I'll still argue that I definitely write my best lyrics when there's no one else there. It's a strange thing when you're in the studio and you've got 3 hours left and you have to come up with a chorus. And it's like, this isn't how you're supposed to create things, you know, like if this doesn't show up in the next 3 hours, like who cares? Like it could take 2 weeks. It just doesn't matter. And So I still like working by myself for that reason, but it took me a long time to be open to it. And if younger songwriters ask me now, I'm just like, it's worth the graft for when you finally do get to work with Mike Dean, or you get to, or you find a lifetime collaborator who does understand what you're doing and you feel completely comfortable in the room with them. It's worth all the weird sessions where you go back to like an Airbnb and you question everything. It is worth that.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Okay, just a reminder, everybody, why we're here. It's the OTB Culture Club. It's sponsored by Now TV. Stream award-winning dramas such as Game of Thrones and Parks and Recreation. Dermot, we're asking everybody to bring a piece of culture to this, to explain it to us, to tease it out. We had Rocky III was our first one with Andy Lee.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it turns out Rocky III, much underrated film, I think.
And, really?
It's well worth a rewatch. It's hilarious, and I'm not sure it always means to be, but I recommend it. You've gone for something classical, I suspect, at this point. We're 20 years on from the release of Gladiator. Why should we put Gladiator in the OTB Culture Club?
The general became a slave. The slave who became a gladiator. The gladiator defied an emperor. Only a famous death will do.
Frost. Sometimes it makes the blade stick.
You find yourself alone, riding in green fields with the sun on your face. Do not be troubled, or you are in Elysium, and you're already dead! Brothers, what we do in life echoes in eternity.
Well, it's funny you should say that about Rocky III, because I watched Gladiator again recently, and it's been my favorite movie forever. So when I was asked about this, I was just like, it's a gimme. Like, my answer is always Gladiator. But I watched it recently, and some of the fight scenes, I was just like, oh dear. it looked old. But it's always been my favorite movie. I think I just love, it's Ridley Scott. And he did Man on Fire too, and Gladiator and Man on Fire to me are kind of similar in the sense that something happens at the beginning and it's this guy's like quest for justice and revenge. And I just think it's a really powerful thing to think. Obviously he's betrayed by Commodus and his wife and son are killed, and he just, that happens early on, and then the whole movie is just his quest to get revenge, and he sort of keeps his head down, stays quiet about the whole thing, and just goes through the phases and eventually gets that face to face with Commodus again. I just think it's the coolest movie ever. Also, it's like it's set in Italy, and when they go to Rome, I just think one of the most, I think when you're in Rome, you can really, I feel like you don't get it in many cities, but when you're in Rome, you can almost feel what it would have been like the Pantheon's still there, the Colosseum's still there, like you can almost imagine what it was like back then, just in terms of landscape and how epic it must have been. So yeah, I love it.
Yeah, the Colosseum is one of those few tourist destination things that you do in the world and you come away with your mind blown. It's not like,
yeah,
oh, you've got to go and see this thing, and you're like, oh yeah, whatever, but then you go there, you're like, holy shit, this is amazing.
Oh man, yeah it's beautiful. Yeah, it there's so much there, and yeah, so, and I love how it's treated with so much reverence. Like when they've sort of had a few fights, and then eventually you get to go to Rome, and your man Proximo, like I was in a band called Shadows and Dust for 4 years. That's actually pretty relevant to this. Yeah, I didn't even think of that, but yeah. I was in a band called Shadows and Dust for 4 years, and that's where that came from. And yeah, the way they go to Rome, and it's just as if it's this incredible, like, this is the pinnacle of their lives. I think it's crazy.
So Dermot Kennedy was basically wandering around quoting Gladiator in every conversation.
I know,
right?
Yeah.
So what is it about the fighting, Dermot, that is not up to scratch in a 2020 context for you?
You know, the first one when they're chained to each other, and he's with that guy that he's kind of like got this friendship with, and I don't know, it looked a little bit like, it just looked like basic or something. You know, these days it would just be the most incredible thing. It just,
it looked like it was made 20 years ago. That's all.
Yeah, even like comparing it to Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones kind of puts it in its back pocket. Like, it's just incredible how it's all moved on in the last 20 years. Like, you mentioned Ridley Scott there. You mentioned Russell Crowe there. Are we seeing two people at this moment in time at the absolute peak of their powers and that combination? And of course, Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, like, his peak is obviously, someone may argue, was 2019. But are we seeing almost at least two peaks here, and that's why we have something so special?
I think so. And it must be a strange thing as an actor. It's in every art form, right? Like, there's probably people who say Kendrick's thing is To Pimp a Butterfly, and that, and who knows, like, he'll probably have a bunch of classic albums. But I'd say a lot of people might be like, that's his moment. And as actors, you're probably pushing for that same thing. And like you said, Joaquin Phoenix's thing could be Joker, and it could just forever be his, like, masterwork. But I feel like that's probably it for Russell Crowe too, yeah. But it must be mad, like, 20 years ago, and then to be still doing it and be like, oh man, I never really touched that again. But I don't know. Yeah, who knows? And also, like, Ridley Scott is just constantly doing cool things. I could have chosen Man on Fire too. I think that's a beautiful movie.
I actually thought that, so I've got a confession to make here. I hadn't sat down and watched the whole thing from start to finish ever, because for whatever reason, I hadn't seen it in the cinema, and then I was going to wait and watch it. And so last night I sat down and watched the whole thing in one continuous go. I'd seen bits of it before. I'd seen the Tigers before, and that was kind of stuck out with me. And I kind of knew what was coming, but it is really, really, really good. There's the politics, there's the fights, which I think are actually do stand up quite well. Certainly the ones with the chariots, I'm like, oh, there was definitely a few.
And when your one gets cut in half by the thing on the
door. Yeah, that was class. And the bit about, I'm going to have to take issue with that, Owen, that Game of Thrones puts it in its back pocket. Game of Thrones is such a rip-off of this. So many of the block, the brother and sister, like, come on.
I'm talking about the fight scenes. I'm giving Dermot credit here for the fight scenes. Like, of course, Game of Thrones puts it in its back pocket with the budget and with the developing technology. As a political story, maybe there is a bit of similarity.
This is an OG. This definitely feels like it's the OG for that. And it kind of,
I love how, like, it's this sort of guy who's so honorable and so sort of like noble, who kind of just holds on to this thing he's got inside him for the whole movie. And even when he is chained up before he fights Commodus at the end, he comes up and, like, hugs him and stabs him, and still he doesn't say anything. And there's so many times when he's, like, done wrong but has to keep his mouth shut. It's the same as fucking Ronaldo in the World Cup final against Germany, like, being knackered and still scoring twice and gets man of the match. Stuff like that. I think stuff like that always resonates with me. And so I think it's really cool.
Dermot, I wanted to ask about your opinion on the score in this film, because it's been a while since I've watched Gladiator back. I'm like, what is this? It's from the very first scene when they're fighting in Germany. I'm like, what is this? What is this music? It's like, this is not Gladiator. It's Pirates of the Caribbean. Absolute note for note Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, thankfully, it is Hans Zimmer involved in both, so I'm not sure if you yourself off. But I hadn't realized that, like, if you're talking about OGs, Pirates of the Caribbean, you were not the first to that incredible soundtrack. Gladiator did it, 4 or 5 years before you?
Right, yeah. And Hans Zimmer's kind of been on everything. There must be times when he's in the studio and he's like, how do I do this again? But yeah, beautiful music. And then the main sort of, that's cool too, the main motif that kind of comes back and in throughout Gladiator, and is that thing where he always thinks of home and thinks of how it used to be. I think that's beautiful. I went to a thing once in the Borgosh Theater, and it was the orchestra playing while the movie was up on screen. A few years ago I went, but it was class. Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah, I often think that, like, Hans Zimmer must get into a studio to write a score for a film. And, you know, like, the thing that came out recently where some university has developed every single melody possible. I think Zimmer is probably just a person who has created every single melody possible that's ever been associated with a film.
And who knows? He's probably got a team of people who get it to 90%, and then he comes in and does his thing. You never know. Like,
I know we've got a couple of other topics to get into on this movie. The other thing that I did when doing a quick bit of research this morning on Gladiator, Dermot, have you heard about Gladiator 2?
No.
Well, first of all, there is Gladiator 2. It's coming sometime down the line. But seriously? The original, there is, yeah. But the original Gladiator 2, Russell Crowe wanted to make a version where he could be in Gladiator 2. And I don't know why he did this, but he asked one Nick Cave to make Gladiator 2, or to write the screenplay for Gladiator 2. So obviously two Aussies, they're probably friends. And Nick Cave writes this entire thing. And he's like, you do know your character is dead in this. And he's like, yeah, go on, still write it. So Nick Cave writes this in the afterlife where Maximus comes back to life, where his family comes back to life. Like there's a BBC article done on this where then the character then starts time traveling, where he goes through the battle through the centuries and the Crusades and the World Wars in Vietnam and then finally in the Pentagon, something resembling X-Men Origins. And Russell Crowe is like, nah, mate, I don't like it. And I got shelved. So like Nick Cave is sitting on a potential blockbuster.
How could you like it?
Yeah, that's like Russell Crowe in South Park. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
What a classic fighting episode. Around the world thing. Yeah.
That might actually be peak Russell Crowe, the fighting around the world, where his reputation is that like everywhere he goes is a weird group of people traveling with him and his entourage is constantly involved in scraps. But actually it's him. They're the ones
it's
dragging
so
out of the
bad
fight.
That when he goes to the hospital and everything, it's so bad.
We asked people for a moment from the movie, in this case, is there a single moment that you're like, yeah, that's the whole hinge point, or that's my favorite scene, or anything that sticks out specifically?
It's funny, it's such a huge movie that some things sort of start to seem cliche, but obviously the Are You Not Entertained bit is classic. Mm-hmm. I think the bit when, in that first battle scene, when he's sort of talking to, it's like almost him and these guys are like this elite group and they're off in a different patch of the forest somewhere. And he said that thing of like, if you find yourself like with the sun on your backs and all, and he was like, don't be afraid because you're in Elysium and you're already dead. I think that's really cool. So I studied ancient Greek and Roman classics in college. I had to do like a minor sort of thing as well as doing music, and that was what I did. So I think it resonates with me for that too, but I just think that's really cool. There's so many bits that are great, but I love that. Yeah.
Did you 100% do classics because of Gladiator? Is that like you're
basically
there going,
yeah,
on to music plus?
Yeah, honestly, I was just like, I knew it would. I just knew it was something I'd be into. I still, even like today, I'll probably go off and play Odyssey, Assassin's Creed, that game. And that's just ancient Greece. And you literally run into like Hermes and Cyclops and all these old characters. It's stuff like that. I've always cared about that.
Do you get a buzz off all historically based television dramas and films? Or like, is it a situation?
Yeah,
where...
yeah, I think so. Like, I could tune into The Crown as well, and I'd be happy enough. Or Downton Abbey. I went to watch that by myself in LA. Like, I think... And even in those, nothing really happens, but just the way they look and just to get a little peek into that life, I just think is crazy, yeah.
Do you feel like you're a storyteller as a musician, or like what's the kind of ratio of the importance of the story I'm telling versus like a singular message versus the ability to carry somebody with the music? I'm wondering how much of the storytelling and narrative side of filmmaking is something that actually appeals to you.
Right. Yeah, no, it is. And when I started, it was the only thing. I had a much smaller appreciation for how the music can move people and how some people just don't care about lyrics. Like some people, it's just not, just music isn't about lyrics for them. I see it when I'm with the lads in the band, and like our bassist is just obviously like what he seeks out in a track is just the bass line and how that makes you feel. And Michal, our drummer, is just constantly like, there's certain arrangements and bands who just are his favorite thing in the world. And I'll go in and check the lyrics, and it's not something I'm into. I'd much rather go and like listen to rap music because that's where it's at its best for me. But I think it's important to do both, because I am more conscious of the fact now that you could go play a gig anywhere in the world and there could be people in the crowd who just lyrics aren't for them. And that's why when I started out, the whole thing was just acoustic, because I saw the guitar and the piano just almost as a vehicle to be able to get these words out. And but now I'm more conscious of the fact that for some people it's purely about the music, and so I'll always be a lyrics guy, but I do see the importance of a proper arrangement now and how that can move people. Oh, you're like the fella on Sky News now.
How are you doing? Hey. These are my kids. Some of them say hello, say goodbye. Right. Oh, and you might take over for a quick second there.
For sure. Yeah. Like that's a really interesting thing that when you're thinking about what is the very thing that gives you meaning, is it a two-way street then when somebody comes back to you and says, listen, I really love the lyrics in that song, or I really love the musical arrangement in that song, that you get a greater kick of hearing that feedback? Is it a two-way street in that regard?
I think I have a certain level of confidence lyrically. Mm. And then I feel like I'm trying to prove myself musically, because if you go into the world of like Moderat and Explosions in the Sky and all these incredible musical arrangements, and we went to see John Hopkins as well, that was amazing, and stuff like that, the way that can move a whole crowd is so amazing. And so I guess my focus has always been like a lyrical thing, and I've always been so focused on how you can move people with your words. And so I feel like I'm almost playing catch up on the musical side of things, but I feel determined to prove myself in that way, because talking about people like Hans Zimmer, like you don't need certain words to just have these incredible feelings from the music. And so I feel like, yeah, if someone goes to my gig and they couldn't care less about lyrics, I still want them to think it's an impressive thing.
Any interest in getting involved in movies at some point? Like,
I'd love it, yeah. But same thing, I feel like I'm so, like, I don't know, I'd be so sort of afraid of it, because I'd be so, like, unequipped or something. You know, there'd be massive sort of imposter syndrome. But I'm sure there's ways to, like, ease your way in and just, like, write a song for a movie. And then next thing you know, you might do a score for a movie and stuff like that, yeah. But I definitely don't see myself just, like, doing music for 20 years and I don't do anything else. I don't see it like that, yeah.
Yeah, you've always got to fall back on your football career, though. That's, like,
that's it, at some point. Come back to over 35.
That dream never dies. I'm going to tell you that right now. No. What's next for you? You've been rearranging tour dates and hoping that this kind of all calms down to the point where you will actually be able to connect with those live audiences again.
Yeah, so basically I had a bunch of tours planned almost until September, and then I was going to take the final quarter of this year just to write and record and start thinking about the second album. And I guess both of those things have just done a flip now, and so all our rescheduled dates that we should have been doing currently are for that part of the year. So I have a bunch of stuff. I'm waiting for a bunch of stuff to get delivered, and I'm essentially setting up a studio at home. So talking about like how I like to make stuff by myself, I'll just be doing that for until we're done. Who knows?
Do you have a place, Dermot, where you tend to get most inspiration from? Like, I can completely imagine the studio is the worst place almost to be put on the spot to write something. Is there a place that you found most success?
Right, yeah. I know I only touched on it a few minutes ago, but like I struggled a lot with this idea of like, okay, you're in London today, you're going to this studio, and inspiration kind of has to strike. I was just like, how does that work? That seems so counterproductive to me. And it was for a long time. And then I just got more comfortable, and now I feel like I can kind of have good ideas, not on demand obviously, but just like the setting becomes less important. But still, favorite place is like the piano in my parents' house. Like, that is just where it works for me. And yeah, it's just literally being alone is so important, because you could be in a session with somebody, and if you sit at a piano and don't make any noise for like 10 minutes, no one's going to ask if you're okay. Like, you can just think for a bit, you know, there's no one else there. And so, yeah, being at home still is the best thing for me. And you got to be careful though, because it can be the most appealing thing and be like, oh, this would be the best work of my life. Like, this is the best thing I ever did. But then you are closed off from how the world might relate to it. So if you're working with somebody like Mike Dean, they might be like, nah, this isn't like culturally relevant, this won't appeal to people. And not that you should ever make something with the sole objective of trying to make people like it, but just I think you can sort of disappear and sort of, I don't know, get a bit too lost in it, and it becomes a bit of a gratuitous thing maybe if you're just doing it by yourself all the time.
There was one last thing I just wanted to ask. It struck me there when you were talking about some of the parallels between sport. You've had an unbelievably successful 18 months, but that's coming at the end of a 10-year period where you were grinding the whole time. So, you know, I became an overnight success after 10 years of hard work. It kind of is a little bit like a sports career where you're kind of cresting to a level now where you feel comfortable, the comfort you talked about being on stage. how do you maintain that peak? How do you make sure that this is now what the new normal is, and that this is the level of expectation for your performance and for your art that you have into the future?
Yeah, and you certainly don't want to be the guy who comes out with the second album and everyone's just like, oh, he just is going to do the same thing like five times. And I think we've left it in a good place off the first album. I think there's enough sort of ballads and enough acoustic stuff balanced out with like hip hop production, program drums and all that. So I feel like it's in a place where we could take it either way. I could do an almost acoustic album, or we could go for it with the production and have it as a much more sort of like hip hop based thing in the way that it sounds. But yeah, I mean, there's like, even between album one and album two, I'm very conscious of the fact that like the world moves on so fast now. So if you do hide away for like years and years, it's almost as if you lose that momentum. And I do get paranoid about that stuff. Like that's why I kind of work so hard, because I'm constantly worried that like you'll be, because there's so many people sort of at the same level. And obviously music's funny in that sense too, because obviously sport is just outright competitive and you should never apologize for that. And you never feel bad about like competing against people. But then music is like, it's based on love and collaboration and sensitivity. So it's like, there shouldn't be that aggression, but it just does exist. Like it does. Like I'm well aware of the fact that there's a million guys with guitars trying to do the same thing. So I guess that's what pushes me forward. But yeah, you just keep working, try and do the best stuff.
Absolutely. Is there a way that you're leaning then, kind of as a final question, is it going to be more acoustic? Is it going to be more produced? I guess the next couple of weeks are actually going to be a really important part of that question.
I think the stripped back song will always be very important to me. And if I ever forget how important that is to me, I feel like I've lost my way a little bit, because that's why I started doing it, like because of Glenn Hansard and because of like Foy Vance and artists like that. That's why I wanted to do it in the first place. And that storytelling thing we were talking about. So if I ever lose sight of that, then I think that's a bad thing. But it's as easy as you could have an album that's fleshed out and is a total sort of like creative risk almost. And then as long as I've got one ballad in there, I'll be happy out. I feel like I've ticked that box, for want of a better phrase, but I feel like I'll have sort of like satisfied that part of me. So no, I really don't know. We'll see. I'm in a place where I'm not even thinking about the second album. I know I'll have to soon-ish, but like currently I'm just making music to make it.
Yeah, it's not a bad situation to find yourself in. Look, you've been great with your time, Dermot, and I think we can all agree that Gladiator, it's kind of a 10 out of 10 movie, right?
It was a safe choice, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was a good one. It was a good one, and I'm delighted to sit down and watch the whole thing from start to finish. So I would recommend, if anybody hasn't seen the whole thing from start to finish, they do it. Well, listen, best of luck. We'll be following you on all your social channels, and whatever comes next, I'm sure it's going to be successful. Dermot Kennedy,
thanks
very much for joining us OTV Culture Club, sponsored by Now TV. Stream award-winning dramas such as Game of Thrones and Parks and Recreation. You can also get Inside Out and Toy Story 4, Grey's Anatomy, and Curb Your Enthusiasm as well. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this.
The OTB Culture Club, brought to you by Now TV. Watch whatever you're in the mood for.